Next case is 07475, State of Ohio versus Philip Elmore. Justice Cupp has recused himself in this case. We're very pleased to have sitting place of Justice Cupp, Judge Timothy Cannon, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals in the 11th Appellate District. Mr. Yazel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel, a person convicted of a criminal offense has the right to be sentenced under the law as it existed at the time of the commission of the offense and is not required to submit to a sentence under the law as subsequently amended. At sentencing, of course, Elmore objected to the application of the Foster remedies. Nonetheless, the court imposed maximum and consecutive sentences for his non-capital offenses. We believe in this case that the application of the Foster remedy deprived Elmore of the constitutional statutory construction presumptions that were in effect in 29-29-14 at the time he committed the offenses. We believe that the Foster remedy retroactively altered the factual prerequisites that the General Assembly decided were appropriate for particular penalties. For instance, the court in Foster removed the presumption of minimum sentences. The court removed the presumption that sentences are to be run concurrently, and the court removed presumptions that the sentences are not to be maximum unless there is some sort of fact finding.
His original sentence was the maximum, right?
Yes.
And that was appealed.
Yes.
And affirmed.
Yes.
Right. So he got what he was entitled to under the statute.
No, you remanded the case for resentencing, Your Honor.
No. I mean, up to that point, forget Foster. Up to that point, legally, he got what he was entitled to.
I don't think the trial court made the proper findings to impose.
Well, you think they erred, but the Court of Appeals affirmed, so.
Well, no, this court affirmed.
Or this court affirmed. So the legal status is he got the proper sentence on those crimes under the laws that existed pre-Foster.
That would be correct. The unfairness here is on remand. The judge in this case was free to impose any sentence, regardless of whether or not the penalty imposed exceeded those statutory presumptions.
Well, counsel, after Foster, the full range is on the table, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. And there is a prior determination in this case that under the prior full range with instructions as to why you don't go to the max, that the trial court did not err in going to the max. So how is his exposure any greater?
There was no finding by this court that the court did not err in sentencing him to maximum, non-minimum, maximum consecutive sentences. This court simply remanded this case for resentencing in light of Foster. The court had the opportunity, had it, because this case, in fact, was filed before Foster and was briefed before Foster, and the court had the opportunity to do that, but did not.
But we weren't required to even look at that.
No, you didn't use this as the vehicle. So what I'm saying is this was never made a determination by this court that those sentences imposed at that time were appropriate.
But the Court of Appeals made such a determination.
There are no Court of Appeals.
No Court of Appeals case. Because of the death case.
Yes, sir.
Right.
But there isn't any language in Foster that specifically removed the minimum, is there? We simply said that you would sentence within the range of penalty specified by the General Assembly appropriate to that case.
You removed the presumptions.
Mm-hmm. Where's the language that removed the presumptions?
The presumption removal language would have been, let me locate that, would have been where you severed the statute.
Well, wasn't the severing, wasn't the severing of the findings made by the trial judge for increasing sentences? Wasn't that what was severed?
You severed the whole thing, and I think that was sort of clear in Bates.
Pardon me, please?
It was sort of clear in Bates that you severed the entire statute. You didn't sever that entire section. You didn't just sever part of it. You severed the whole thing. I think Bates stands for that proposition.
Well, the findings that trial courts were required to make were declared to be unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court in a whole series of cases, starting with Apprendi and Ring and a whole series. And in following that, all we did was eliminate the finding requirements of the trial courts in imposing sentence.
I believe you also eliminated the constitutional statutory presumptions. If you will recall, the court's opinion in Foster said that these constitutional statutory presumptions no longer had any, quote, meaning after you severed the unconstitutional fact-finding.
Well, there isn't any constitutional right to a minimum sentence, is there? Or are you arguing that there is?
I'm arguing
that's a statutory presumption, which we did not necessarily sever.
I'm arguing that defendants have a liberty interest, Your Honor. They certainly would have a liberty interest. There's certainly no right to constitutional right to appeal a sentence. There's no right, the right to appeal in Ohio, of course, is statutory. But Elmore has a liberty interest, Your Honor, and he has a liberty interest in having a sentence imposed in accordance with the state statutes. And I think Hicks versus Oklahoma is the lead case on that. Now, if the law's substantive predicates are established, then the defendant has the right to have that sentence imposed in accordance with those substantive predicates that the statute sets up. What happened here was you got rid of the substantive predicates, not only for Elmore, but for everyone else.
Counsel, I'm trying to determine, is this the case of first impression for us as to whether or not anyone subsequent to Foster can, the trial judge can give the full range of sentences, or are those cases unaffected? I'm trying to put a fence around what is affected by what you have in front of us today.
I think what we have here is we have a question of whether Foster remedies can be applied retroactively. The court said they could.
So that would not affect anyone's case who is in court after Foster is announced for the first time.
It would not affect anybody who committed their crime after Foster was announced, not in court, after commission the offense.
Okay. So that's the demarcation line.
That would be our demarcation line, and that, right. Of course, would.
And so all of those whose case was the offense was committed, charged or not, you're using the date of the offense as the line of demarcation.
Yes, sir.
So you're suggesting that anything where the offense is committed after Foster is announced, the Foster rules apply, and for those, for all defendants who committed the offense prior to Foster being announced, the resentencing has to be to minimum sentence, period.
Minimum concurrent sentences, yes. As the law was at that
Counsel, point. How could you have it both ways, that you agree that those sentences should be remanded for resentencing based on Foster, the fact-finding having been eradicated by Foster, yet saying that other sections that had been severed apply?
Well, that's because, Your Honor, when you applied Revised Code 1.50, you went too far. And what you did was you severed not only unconstitutional provisions, but constitutional provisions.
And you're basing that on the constitutional right to freedom.
I'm basing that on the fact that statutory presumptions are constitutional. The United States Supreme Court in Blakely, Booker, any of the cases going back has never said that, well, we don't have to have statutory presumptions. We can. We can have statutory presumptions. They're not worried about the minimum. They're worried about the maximum. That's the teaching of Booker.
So what would be the circumstances under which you would envision a trial court imposing the maximum as opposed to the minimum?
To a person who committed their offense prior to Foster?
Yes.
I don't think you can impose a sentence.
So you're saying that unilaterally, exclusively, these defendants are entitled to the minimum sentence no matter what the circumstances of their crime?
No. There is no judicial fact-finding involved in the statutory presumptions for minimum concurrent sentences.
Correct.
There is certainly judicial fact-finding was involved in anything above that. And that's what Blakely says is wrong.
And if you take away the fact-finding, as Foster did, all right, let's back up pre-Foster, because that's where you want to be here. How do you get to more than the minimum sentence then to be imposed by the court?
You couldn't. You couldn't impose more than the minimum sentence.
What I just said was that anybody who had committed a crime pre-Foster will always get the minimum sentence under your scenario, that a court cannot elevate it.
That would be true for cases that were pre-Foster that are still in the pipeline.
I understand.
Because everything else is water under the bridge as far as the federal constitution would be concerned.
Your argument, though, was rejected, and the same argument was made when Foster was being decided. So aren't you, in effect, asking us to reverse Foster in part?
I would disagree that this decision was made in Foster, because it's not clear from Foster that it was made. And in fact, I recall that it was briefed subsequent to the issuance of the opinion as to the retroactivity, and you didn't do anything.
We applied the Booker remedy, however. I mean, when we looked at Blakely and Apprendi and all of those cases and said that the court cannot give a or make findings of fact that are not rendered by the jury and then oppose a greater sentence, that's why we severed that particular portion. The court has complete discretion within the statutory range, and we were very clear about that, rejecting the argument that was made that all of these sentences then would revert to the minimum.
I don't think you really applied the Booker remedy, and I'll tell you why. In Booker, what they did is they went from a mandatory guideline system to an advisory guideline system. These constitutional provisions that you severed, which dealt with the presumptions, are the problem. Because what you could have done instead of severing those constitutional provisions is actually done what they did in Booker. You could have done this. You could have kept appellate review to determine reasonableness, you know, whether the sentence was imposed regarding consideration of those presumptions, just like the feds did in Booker. You didn't do that. You didn't think about the greater purposes of sentencing other than it relates to 29-29-11 and go into all these other purposes of sentencing. You didn't render anything advisory. You simply eliminated in Foster these provisions. And the freedom of the trial court to sentence now is essentially unfettered. It's really unreviewable as a practical
matter. Well, counsel, then that's not quite true. I mean, you still can review for reasonableness. That we did not tell the courts of appeals that they could not reverse for unreasonable. And in fact, we've looked at a couple of cases where there were extreme sentences. We didn't overturn them, but we had a lively debate about somebody getting 100 years or so. And in fact, to enlighten you a little more, there was a draft concurrence or dissent, I don't recall which it was, that would have taken the position you have taken. So we internally considered the possibility of doing exactly what you advocate is should apply to all the defendants whose cases were in the stream at the time, and what we ultimately published didn't do that, as Justice Lansinger said, that discussion was on the table and was entertained. So somebody brought it up.
Okay.
Let me suggest to you that a smaller fence might be a more feasible argument, and that is for all of those cases where the appeal has been taken and the sentence that was imposed was not found to be improper, and then Foster has announced that on resentencing, you could resentence up to at least what they got in the first place. Maybe you couldn't go, maybe there's an argument that you shouldn't be able to go higher on resentencing, but since that, under the guidelines that were in place at the time, was blessed, and that's over, but your case might be different because you argue, not only were you arguing about the death penalty nature of it, but you were arguing about the appropriateness of the sentencing on these underlying charges, and that there wasn't a determination on that. So your client is entitled to the minimum.
All right. Well, Your Honor, my time is up.
Yeah.
You may, if you want to respond.
You want to respond to that?
I would like to respond, Your Honor, just briefly, that yes, you've reviewed cases for reasonableness, but you don't do what the feds do, which is review them for procedural reasonableness. And by procedural reasonableness, what I mean is they maintain these advisory guidelines, just like you could have maintained these advisory presumptions. And they look and see whether the court
Well, I thought that's what Foster did. Foster left them there to be considered, but
I don't believe they're there, Your Honor. I believe Bates says you severed it all. But other than that, as I said, my time has expired.
One more question here, Counselor. What's an advisory presumption?
Excuse me?
What's an advisory presumption? You just used that term
I'm
that
sorry,
we could have preserved advisory presumption, and I don't know what that means.
You did not preserve those presumptions as advisory. You severed the whole sentence. It was gone. You severed that portion of the revised code. You cut it out in Foster. That's what Bates says. There was nothing left of the 29-29-14. I believe it's C.
Are you saying that the presumption of minimum sentencing is could have been retained as an advisory presumption?
Yes. All the presumptions could have been retained as advisory. I do not believe that you
Isn't
did
that what the U.S. Supreme Court did? That's your point, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diesel. Mr. Oswald.
Good morning. I'm in the Licking County Prosecutor. I have an interesting historical fact that may or may not be you find as coincidental as I. First of all, this issue before you today is not the first time this issue has been discussed by me in the court because I happen to be counsel on Foster. Mm-hmm. Andrew Foster was my case out of Licking County.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Not to mention that now this is the second time I'm here on this case. That makes three Blakely-related cases now out of Licking County. But what's curious is the remedy you chose to use in Foster, Geiger versus Geiger, 1927 case, which, of course, I was not around for. Came out of Licking County, so somehow Licking County, Ohio, has a monopoly on severance and Blakely-related connection for some reason. In this particular case,
is it your view, Mr. Oswald, that the advisory presumption, to use the term that's been used earlier, was eliminated in Foster or confirmed in Bates, or is it your view that it might still be part of that statute?
I would echo Justice O'Connor's question as whether or not there is such a thing. These are guidelines. They're guidelines post-Foster that a court is required to consider but need not follow.
Well,
but they
is there any language in Foster that eliminated those guidelines, to your knowledge?
Eliminated the guidelines?
Well,
no.
If eliminated the guideline says that the presumption for a trial court will be that the minimum sentence shall be imposed unless the trial court makes requisite findings to justify more than the minimum sentence. I think that's what we're talking about.
Okay.
We know that in Foster we eliminated the language that required a trial court to make findings based on the decisions of the United States Supreme Court, in eliminating federal guidelines similarly.
Okay.
But I guess the question I'm trying to get to is there any language in Foster that then eliminated the presumption of a minimum sentence that a trial judge wouldn't have the presumption of a minimum sentence, other than our language that says as long as the court sentence is within the range for that particular category of felony?
I would say yes. There are sections that in Foster indicate that these are now guidelines. If you're asking, does Foster opinion take these code provisions and X out or, you know, strike through certain, so that's crystal clear exactly what section? No. However, paragraph 97 of the opinion, it says the following sections, because they either create presumptive minimum, there's the presumptive, or concurrent terms, or require judicial fact-finding to overcome the presumption, again, the word presumption, have no meaning now that judicial findings are unconstitutional. It cites 29.29.14b, 29.29.19b2, and 29.29.41. So I guess my answer to that, the best I can glean from that, especially the reference to in Foster and later in Bates and Kalish, that these are guidelines. With that said, however, they're guidelines not only for the trial court that's expected to follow or look at or consider, but not required to. They're also guidelines, presumably, Court of Appeals looking at reasonableness would also look to. If every guideline favored community control, but a trial judge gave a maximum sentence, I would hope a court of appeals say, wait a minute, what's going on here? That's not reasonable. That's an abuse of your discretion. And therefore, order resentencing.
Counsel, would this be a fair observation about what was left after Foster and Bates? And that is that these things that were spelled out that were determined in Foster to be requirements that violated Booker required fact-finding. We didn't strike them from the revised code, I don't think. I think they were left there for judges to read for their edification and assistance as they made up their mind, and they were told, you now have the full range of sentence that applies to that particular offense. So these are there for your reading, for your thoughtful, prayerful reflection, and no more.
Well, I would add one more to that. They are there for your ability to determine what the legislature, the lawmaking body, considers
right.
important to sentencing determinations.
Right.
So I would add, but
well,
that is
yeah,
what,
they're obviously put there by the legislature
right.
and not by the court, yeah.
But they are guidelines. All Foster did is strike the presumptive or the mandatory finding to go to those higher end sentences.
Now, but Foster also struck the presumption, as Justice O'Donnell was asking, that it's the minimum sentence unless you find these things.
That's correct. That's 29.29.14b specifically, which was part of the passage I just read from the Foster opinion. Mm-hmm. The only issue in this case that's really coming here today, and what's actually happening today, is in the supplemental brief the first time we came here, what they asked for was a resentencing, noting that the code sections were unconstitutional under Blakely. Okay? That's what they got, a resentencing. Okay? And what they got is now what they're arguing about. They got a resentencing. They want to say, well, yeah, we wanted a resentencing, but we wanted minimum concurrent sentence. Justice Lansinger, you were exactly correct. That was specifically rejected at paragraph 88 of the opinion you drafted in Foster. Okay? They're asking for something they were specifically denied earlier. In this particular case, what they want to argue now is that, wait a minute, to resentence me post-Foster is a violation of ex post facto or due process. And I will kind of use those interchangeable after making this notation. Ex post facto law does, the clause, does not apply strictly to judicial determinations. Okay? However, Supreme Court has said concepts of ex post facto are involved in due process, okay? In this particular instance, their arguing is, wait a minute, this change resulting from Foster cannot be implied to me because I committed my crime before Foster, okay? And therefore, I want minimum concurrent sentences because the guidelines now can't be used under Foster because it violates ex post facto. That's what they're arguing now. Here, however, I want to point out they could have made that argument the first time we were here. The first time we were here, they could have said, not only do these statutes violate Blakely, which is what they did argue, knowing full well that by that time, Booker and by the time we argued, Foster had been handed down and knew exactly what was going to happen. Did they say, wait a minute, you can't do what you did in Foster in Elmore 1 because that violate ex post facto? No, they didn't. They let it go back to the Common Pleas Court for resentencing and raise it then for the first time. Mm-hmm. That's a forfeiture. In Foster, I made that argument under the use of the term waiver. It was rejected. A year later in Payne, the court accepted Blakely issues can be forfeited, okay? I suggest that they didn't make this argument earlier. It's forfeited in this case. But with that said, I don't want you to duck this issue. I am one of 88 county prosecutors waiting for you to answer two questions. One that is specifically briefed, and one is thrown upon us in the middle of the briefing schedule. The one that's briefed is ex post facto slash due process. And I'm telling you, I have found no case that has accepted this argument anywhere. Not a federal case, the appellate level. In last month, the district courts of this state, North End, Southern District, have rejected this ex post facto issue entirely. And what you would have to believe is that 16 Supreme Court justices, the 7 sitting here and the 9 in Washington, when Booker was decided and Foster decided, completely lost the whole idea about, wait a minute, if we'd make this change applicable to all these people, we've got an ex post facto problem. I really don't think 16 justices made that mistake. Even in the dissents in Booker, for heaven's sakes, all the arguments they were saying is why this remedial change shouldn't be done. It doesn't make any sense. It's not one of them said. And oh, by the way, I think it would result in ex post facto due process concerns. You can't do that. In this particular case, what's happened here is something that I can't find another case on. Another fact pattern on, and that's this. The ex post facto law or clause, those cases that apply it or try to apply it as a due process component of judicial determinations like Bowie and Columbia, City of Columbia, Rogers in Tennessee, don't have one thing this case does. Those changes in the law were because either the judiciary decided to interpreted a common law provision about burglary. That's one of the cases, okay? They just had a change of mind on how the law should be interpreted. Or the legislature has done something. I can find no other situation where the change in law isn't a change of mind. It's being implemented as a constitutional remedy, a remedy of one constitutional violation. In other words, what you'd have to say, we've remedied one constitutional problem under Blakely by creating another one. I don't see any cases that says a severance, a remedy of a constitutional problem creates itself one. Can't find a single case. But that's what you'd have to hold to buy their argument today. In this particular case, the other issue that I want you to handle square on that really hasn't been briefed is Oregon versus ICE. In Foster, one of the many sections struck down as unconstitutional had to do with the findings necessary for consecutive sentencing. Okay? This court said Blakely and Booker apply to the findings necessary for consecutive sentencing. Out they go. Those, like the rest of the ones we severed, are now discretionary guidelines. While this case was pending, January of this year, the United States Supreme Court, in a very split decision, 5-4, decided that Blakely, Apprendi, Ring, all those line of cases do not apply to consecutive sentencing. So the issue here.
So you want us to reverse our holding in Foster on that issue?
No, I don't, and here's why. The reason I'm raising it is because I think the defense or the appellant will ask you that, or during your looking at this matter, you're going
to
find it.
Maybe expedite this. I think we've taken a case, at least one case, in which we're going to be reviewing the application of ICE.
Okay.
We wouldn't want to decide in this case without briefing, certainly. You're asking us to decide an issue that has been briefed here.
No, I'm asking you because if you're going to order a resentencing, we need to know what to do on the consecutive. It's going to affect this case. All I'm asking is you to either ask it for briefing. If you're going to hold that issue off until you get the other case, I don't care. I just didn't know your intent. All I know is that we need an answer to that case, that matter in this case, if you're going to order any kind of resentencing.
Right.
And I would point out this. I think in Ohio, revival, whereas this court has held in, used in a board of, Franklin County Board of Elections versus Snyder, revivifying laws in Ohio cannot be done except by reenactment. In other words, if you, as a group of justices, decide that Foster was wrongly decided on the consecutive issue, because now we have the benefit of Oregon versus ICE, we didn't before, it doesn't pop back to existence. It doesn't pop back
to existence. Mr. Aswell, Mr. Elmore's been sentenced initially in the capital case, and then the death penalty was overturned. Am I correct about that?
No. He is on death row now.
He is.
All right. In fact, one of the arguments I made in the first go-around is this issue is moot as long as the death penalty is in place.
Okay. And the sentencing on the non-capital offenses, he's been sentenced twice on that?
One pre-Foster, one post-Foster, yes. Same sentence.
But those sentences are exactly the same.
Exactly.
So there is no additional imposition of years between the pre-Foster sentence and the post-Foster sentence.
You are correct.
Okay.
Exact same sentence.
Counsel, if in the question I put to the other side, if prior to Foster, the reasonableness of the sentence was fully litigated, and that case was over, and then along comes Foster, do we have any of those where they're going back for resentencing? And if they are, do you think the trial court's free to go above whatever was imposed the first time around?
I think yes. The answer is yes. In my experience in Licking County, it hasn't ever happened.
Yeah.
It has not happened.
I don't think we've heard about it happening.
But in this particular case, if you're going to really, truly use severance to say these are discretionary guidelines, you can't, it seems to me, unless you can establish that the trial court is punishing the person for an appeal, there's a line of cases that say you can't do that. Absent that, if it's going to be discretionary guidelines, it has to be discretionary guidelines. But it's not applicable to this case, but I appreciate the question, and I've not had any experience, with one exception. I did have an agreed-upon modification in Licking County. But other than that, it's been identical all the way across.
Thank you, Mr. Oswald.
Thank you.
Mr. Yuzo, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
In this case, there is no presumption of vindictiveness. Mr. Elmore certainly was sentenced the same each time. There are a bunch of cases that happened where this has occurred, and that's in Union County, but I believe the judicial member is no longer a judge, so this is happening less and less. The thing that I think is very important in this case, and I hope that the court focuses on this in their decision, is the proper test to impose when looking at whether or not these laws are retroactive. Fair warning is not the test, and I want you to understand why fair warning is not the test, because I believe this is where a series of problems occur when one looks at judicial retroactivity of judicial decisions. Fair warning analysis is only proper when previously innocent conduct has been criminalized. That's what the teaching is in Rogers at page 549. Rogers dealt, of course, with the abolishment of the year end of the day homicide rule from the common law. Bowie dealt with enlarging a criminal statute and criminalizing previously actually legal trespass type of conduct. And it is our position that the Rogers test applies to retroactivity here, Your Honor. And we believe that is the test that you should apply, which means you have to look at whether the interpretation was foreseeable, was it unexpected, is it indefensible with respect to prior law, which of course we believe that it's indefensible as it relates to section 1.50 and, of course, Mason versus Griffin.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you believe that Oregon versus ICE needs to be mentioned?
Actually, I do, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why, and I'll tell you very briefly why. Ever since you've severed these provisions, including the consecutive sentence provisions in 2929.14, the General Assembly has reenacted in toto the statutes that you've severed. So let me give you the example that I think is crucial here for ICE. ICE was decided January 14th, 2009. The General Assembly reenacted 2929.14(e)(4), 4709. I suggest to you that your law in Bates is bad law and that every judge should be doing what the General Assembly told him to do, because your law is bad because ICE says that your basis for your decision is wrong. And that is crucial, and I know that you briefed it, but I'll tell you what, I would be raising this issue if I was at the trial court in every sentencing, because I believe that the presumptions and the rules are back in effect, and they've been in effect at least since 4909, when the General Assembly reenacted that in toto. If there are no further questions about that, I'm finished.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Judge.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.